In the latest episode of University Radio Trials Talking About Stuff, I chat with Dr. George Turner, University Secretary and Clerk to the Council at the University of Roehampton. We naturally discuss George's early academic career, which quite distinctively started out with him forming a punk band at 16 and then being inspired to study music at Sheffield. He stuck with music as a discipline, ending up with a PhD thesis on the place of the electric guitar, before deciding he needed to earn some money and taking the first job he could, which happened to be at the University of Derby. After a period working as a cleaner at the university, he moved into the challenging area of student complaints, and then, bizarrely, turned down a job offer at the University of Nottingham in favour of an opportunity at Brunel. Following a brief diversion on the changing emphasis on the importance of strong written English in university administration, and noting that the bigger issue for George is skills in data presentation, we move on to his next career step, being encouraged by a great boss to apply for the job of Deputy Secretary at Roehampton. Whilst a big step up, he had a real opportunity to grow in the role, including honing those governance skills through taking on support for council committees. The change in Vice-Chancellor resulted in the creation of a new role of University Secretary, which George successfully applied for. Although admitting to his fair share of imposter syndrome from time to time, he cites the really strong and supportive environment at Roehampton. We talk about the features of the university, including its long history, from its original constituent colleges, three of which include a religious dimension, bringing some interesting perspectives to council. And naturally, we discuss regulation too, and the approaches to dealing with regulators' expectations on council in terms of compliance and the impact on its work. And finally, we discover that, like me, George is a big fan of campus security reports. It's a really good conversation, and I do hope you enjoy it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. My name's Paul Greatrix, and this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Dr. George Turner, who is University Secretary and Clerk to the Council at the University of Roehampton. Welcome, George.
Hi, Paul. Thanks very much for having me.
It's great to have you on board. So we're going to have a wee chat about your career and about higher education more generally. As a kind of kickoff, and I should tell listeners and fess up, right? I mean, I think, you know, George and I have hardly spoken at all ever, despite the small world of registrars and such like in higher education. You know, we don't get the opportunity to mingle that often, being secretive, solitary types. So it's a really great opportunity for me. So I'm really pleased to be spending a bit of virtual time with you, George. So it's good to have you.
Yeah, it's really nice to be here, Paul.
Good. Well, let's start with you then, because you're at the University of Roehampton, but you've got possibly a slightly unconventional academic career for someone who's ended up in your position. So talk us through that, because you started off studying music, and you're not the only registrar who's done that, because Lucinda at Bristol, who you can hear on an earlier podcast, started in exactly the same place as you, I think.
Yeah, I think there are a few more as well, actually. It's quite interesting. And the CEO at Roehampton studied music as well as an undergrad, so it's more common than you'd imagine. I don't really know where it started, but my desire to come and study music at uni started in my garage, age 16. I started a punk band with some of my school friends. I used to play guitar, okay, sing very poorly. And, you know, it was the best thing I probably have ever done in my life. It was so much fun. And we got to that kind of age, you know, 16, end of 16, early 17. And I don't think I even had thought about uni, but most of my friends were thinking about going, and they were all making their plans. And in the end, you know, I thought, why not? I went to see a friend in Sheffield, which is where I studied eventually. And basically we had a really good party on a Wednesday night, and I came home and I thought, I could do that for a few years. That sounds great. And if I studied music, even better. So went to Sheffield, did an undergrad in music. I got to the end of that. It's a bit of a theme, actually. I didn't really know what to do after my degree, but I'd met some great academic colleagues within the department. Really liked Sheffield, really enjoying the kind of the more pure academic components of the music programme, so sort of musicology. So I thought, I'll do a PhD. And so that's how that kind of idea was born. I wrote my thesis on the electric guitar broadly the way that popular discourse around the electric guitar and associated music has evolved over time, and the themes that emerge from that, and the, you know, questions of identity and creativity and things like that. So
wow.
It was quite, I have to say, it's quite self-indulgent as a PhD. I found it super interesting.
But that's the nature of, you know, that kind of you know, research apprenticeship, though. I mean, it's got to be something that is either of interest to someone else or profound interest to you. And, you know, the reality is you don't necessarily get a lot of coverage or a lot of external interest. But I can imagine that being of, you know, real niche interest to people who like guitars.
I would think so. And I think, you know, you could probably have written what I wrote from a non-academic perspective and made it more kind of commercially appealing, and it probably would have done okay. Yeah, I mean, I think you quickly learn as a PhD student that you know, your research is tremendously interesting and important to you and hopefully a community around you. But certainly it became clear to me that it wasn't going to change the world. I did that full time for a few years, and I imagine, like a lot of PhD students, I got to the end of my writing up periods. I was skint. You know, like a lot of kind of arts and humanities PhD students, I was a bit fed up of sitting on my own writing a thesis, and actually I just wanted to go get a job for a bit and have some security and some certainty and work with some other people. And I was living in Derby, and I lived right next to the University of Derby by chance. So I went to work at the University of Derby.
You just strolled in and said, "Here's a job"?
No, I applied for a job as a cleaner, 6 a.m. cleaner. So I'd clean for a few hours and then I'd write my thesis. And when I finished, I applied for a job in student services. So my job was student complaints officer. And I think I was given the job because I could write, essentially. So that was one of the skills I picked up from my PhD. I really enjoyed it. The world of sort of university administration was completely alien to me, but I really, really enjoyed it. it's quite an interesting area. You see a lot of the university, you see things that have gone wrong, but the best, well, there's two things I really enjoyed about it. One was you did actually get to fix things for students, and it was that kind of direct impact. You know, you could see the effect of the work that you were doing, which, you know, I found really refreshing. And then, you know, I started to realise that I quite enjoyed this kind of the type of work where there's a lot of kind of close analysis, reading, thinking, you know, coming up with solutions. So I just had a great time. Paul, I actually applied then for a job at University of Nottingham.
Oh, no. Oh, really?
I applied for a job with you, and I applied for a job at Brunel. doing more or less the same thing. It was a slightly more senior version of the role. And you offered me a job. But
oh, did we? Oh, that's good.
I made it. Yeah, it was great. I was really pleased. But I decided to go to London. Because I really wanted to go live in London. Me and my wife were dead set on going to the capital. So we went off to...
What did we miss? What did we miss? I don't know. Well, at least we clearly made a sensible judgment on your potential and ability. So that was a good thing, right? Okay, so you went to, were you still, was it a different kind of role then at Brunel that you followed up, or was it still in the same vein?
Yeah, it's a similar type of thing. It's slightly more senior, slightly broader, but. Complaints, academic appeals, student misconduct, all these things.
It's a growth area, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a growth area. It's becoming more, I don't think this is a good thing at all, but I feel it's becoming more kind of legalistic, and you know, we're working a lot more with our solicitors on these types of things, isn't it? I understand why it has become like that, but I don't feel it's a particularly positive development for us or for students, actually.
We'll come on to your next move in a minute, but look, just on this one, I think you're absolutely right, and it represents an ever greater risk, you know, to universities as well, which, you know, they seek to mitigate, we all seek to mitigate, by, you know, getting more people to work on the solutions, but also, as you say, to get that legal input, because the you know, there's a risk of exposure there. But I go back to one of the first things you said about the ability to write. I mean, I have to say, you know, I mean, it's really easy for me to say this as a, you know, having been around for a long time, but the standards of written English amongst professional staff are not what they were, right? When I started, and you know, and that's not just kind of golden age nostalgia. I think it's, you know, it's pretty easy to evidence, and it's just the nature of education has changed, and the nature of, you know, the tools that you use, etc., has changed. But I think it does make the job harder, right? Because actually you need to spend a lot more time correcting and being precise in wording, whereas you used to be able to make assumptions that people could write properly and it would all be fine and everyone would be able to do it. And I think that has changed beyond recognition. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my impression is that as a skill, it's not called upon as much. You know, we do a lot more informal writing, quick emails, you know, it's much more conversational. I think, you know, sort of fast forwarding to the role I do now as Secretary to Council, you know, I'm sure like you, we spend hours and hours making sure that the papers we send out are, you know, as good a quality as possible. And I have a colleague in my team who is exceptional at, you know, proofreading and tidying things up and making us all sound much more intelligent than we actually are. And perhaps, you know, perhaps in times gone by that wouldn't have been necessary. But I think it's probably just, for me, it's a product of the way that we work and the skills that we practice every day.
I think you're right. I shouldn't be bemoaning it, but that it's undoubtedly different. And of course, you know, people bring different skills, right? Yeah. And they may not be the skills that I or others particularly value, but they do bring different skills. But yes, yeah, certainly when I was, you know, in earlier stages of my career, you know, the ability to write plain, clear English, and then the ability to write minutes in particular were the hallmarks of, you know, any aspiring administrator, right? If you couldn't do that, you were going to struggle, right? And but I think you're right, things have changed and the expectations are different, but that means that getting people who are able to write those minutes for council, etc., absolutely right, is harder, and it's more, you know, it requires more effort to get it absolutely right. You're right.
Yeah, I think if I had to bemoan anything, I'd bemoan the kind of lack of skills around presenting data well. Actually, I am when you see it done well and someone puts together a really sort of intuitive dashboard and you look at it and you know exactly what they're trying to say, it's kind of a bit of a game changer, and you see so much stuff that is kind of horrible tables and graphs that you can't really read and stuff like that. So I think if I had one, if there's one thing I could change, it probably wouldn't be written English. It'd be presentation data.
That's for, I mean, I'm not giving you a wish, but you can have it, right? Because I'm sure we would all benefit from that, and it's certainly a skill I wish I had. Right, so let's get back to Brunel. So you're at Brunel, you're doing more and bigger stuff around complaints and appeals. So how long did you stay at Brunel?
I was there just over a year. Brunel's great. I really enjoyed working there. It was actually a bit of a sort of transformational time. I had a feature of my career today, but I had a really great boss, and she was an ex-city lawyer who had kind of moved into the sector at a point in time. She was super smart, really, really, really engaged, but really supportive of me and my development. And she did two things, actually. So she said to me, I think you'd really enjoy studying some law, and I think it would really help with the work that you do for Brunel. So I did the graduate diploma in law, which is, less common now, but it was a sort of, I did it part-time, so it was 2 years condensed, going from no law to, a lot of law. And I did that, during the day, I'd sort of step out of work and go to lectures and things like that at Brunel. So that was great. And again, sort of setting me up for the role I do now in a really significant way. And then the other thing she did for me is she she saw a job at Roehampton, which was as deputy secretary. And she said, you could do this job. You could go and do this job. You've got all the things that you need. Actually, the role is not too far away from what you do now and what you've done for us. So you should apply and I'll help you. And so I did. I applied for that. And I have no idea how I got it. Objectively, I shouldn't have had a chance. But went to the interview, met some great people at Roehampton, really enjoyed it, and was lucky enough to get the offer to come and be deputy secretary, which was like a massive step up. And at that point, I didn't have much kind of full-time work experience under my belt, a couple of years. And I was line managing for the first time. I remember the day I started, the VC called me into his office to say hello and, how are you settling in? And I was like, oh my God, this is the vice chancellor, So yeah, really, really significant gear shift for me.
Yeah.
It was, that was 6 years ago now. So I've been with Roehampton for 6 years. And I did that role for a couple of years, about 2.5 years, and sort of gradually expanded the work that I was doing, started doing more work for council and the council committees. So at a point in time, we had a secretary and registrar who had a very broad kind of professional services portfolio who I reported to. And he effectively delegated all of the council stuff to me to do. And that gave me this sort of great exposure to, our chair of council and our non-execs and actually colleagues on the exec board that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. So, it was really good. And then we appointed a new VC in 2019, Jean-Noël. He came in and he totally changed the organization. And, it was unlike anything I'd ever known and really exciting. And then in 2020, our secretary and registrar left and he went to do something else. And Jean-Noël said, we'd like you to apply to be university secretary. So I did. And I was lucky enough to get it. And Yeah, so that's kind of
so they split the secretary and registrar role to make it secretary and COO. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we had kind of before that we had a PVC, but he was also a director of finance, and he had estates and IT and those kinds of things, and that all got combined into one mega coup role. Bit of change there, but opened up a really exciting opportunity for me.
So just going back to your start then, you're suddenly pitched into this, you know, more senior role, as you say, without line management experience. So how, what support did you get then in terms of that role? Because, you know, it's a bit of a sink or swim thing, but, you know, you do need help when you're first starting out at that level of seniority. Who did you have to turn to?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, I remember it being a time when I felt really well supported. So I was working for the secretary and registrar, and theme of great bosses. He was really supportive of me, but in a kind of, you can go and do this, you don't need me, you know, just have a go and it'll be fine kind of way. And actually, Roehampton, one of the things it's really good at is promoting people into positions and really supporting them to develop. So relatively senior people at relatively kind of early stages in their career. And so there's a few of us at Roehampton that find ourselves in these quite senior roles at quite early stages in our career. And I think it feels like it's part of the culture, which is, you know, quite exciting and makes you feel, you don't feel unusual or like you're kind of, out of the ordinary. I don't know. I think that said, there's definitely, and I'm sure lots of people feel this for different reasons, there's a lot of imposter syndrome. So you're sat there thinking, when are they going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing? You know, when are they going to realise that they've made a huge mistake? Something I've done is going to go wrong, and that's going to be it. I'm going to be finished. And I felt like that for a really long time, and still do.
Yeah, yeah. So would you say that? I mean, it does sound like a really supportive and positive environment, right? Which is great. Does that kind of permeate professional services at Roehampton? Would you say?
I think so. I think probably, you know, reflecting honestly, we probably haven't done enough to kind of support the development of colleagues, particularly in kind of management roles within professional services. And I think that's actually changing now. I think particularly kind of post-pandemic, when we're starting to think in a more long-term way, we are starting to address that. But I think the impact is there's a lot of talent within professional services that hasn't been kind of fully unlocked, you know, particularly sort of management talent. I say I felt really supported, but I didn't have any sort of formal line management training or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you might feel differently, but that feels to me like a bit of a theme within our sector, is that, you know, you just go and do it and see what happens. And, you know, I think that's something, again, that we're trying to address, because there's value in it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think it's more common on the academic side to have people pitched into suddenly being line managers with, you know, with no experience, but expected to do everything. It is more normal. You could argue to kind of work your way up gradually in professional services, but you can still find yourself pitched into waving over. But you're right. There are plenty of good vehicles for training and development on line management, which absolutely should be part of the package, because it's so big a feature of what life is like in professional services.
Yeah. I often think it. we're a sector dedicated to educating and training and generating new knowledge. And you know, if we don't think there's value in applying that to professional services, what on earth are we doing?
I completely agree. But it's all too easy for us to be to decide not to invest in that and to choose a different. Tell us a bit about Roehampton then, for those who don't know, like me. You know, it's a bit about its history and the kind of scale and the kind of range of activity. And remind me roughly where it is, because I always think I know where it is and I get it wrong.
Yeah, so we're southwest London, not far from Wimbledon.
Right.
Richmond Park is the other kind of landmark close by. It's a nice, really nice campus. Lots of green space, lots of heritage buildings. It's a really lovely place to work. So Roehampton, it's got a bit of an odd history, but it's a post 92. I suppose over our history, we started as focusing on teacher training. So we've got a really strong reputation for teacher training, and gradually moved into, you know, more of a sort of full service academic portfolio. Quite probably focused on teaching and learning. We have a strong research profile, but not in a, you know, Russell Group research intensive type way. Probably in the last sort of 4 years, the portfolio has developed to include new things like nursing. So we started nursing 4 years ago, and that's really, you know, taken off in a major way. It's been really fantastic. We're looking at things like engineering for the first time, and you know, architecture and things like that, which again, I think we're really, really excited about. Still strong teacher training provision, and you know, more broadly a kind of full range of academic disciplines. You know, growing business school, relatively new, but doing really well as our law school. So that's kind of where we're at. We're about 12,000 students all in at the moment, and about 1,000 staff. We've got this. It's interesting to me from a governance perspective, and I think probably from a historical perspective as well. We've got this unusual history. So we're a collegiate organization, so although we're as a university we're relatively new. Our first college was established in the 19th century. It's been going 150 years, so we have these four colleges, all of which were set up as teacher training colleges, all of which have gradually over 100 or so years got closer together until they became one university. And there's lots of interesting quirks there in terms of how the place operates. And we still have college teams that are focused on kind of community and you know, building, you know, promoting the values of the founding colleges and things like that. So does
that impact on, you know, day to day life very much then, or is it more in the kind of realms of, you know, tradition and you know, ceremony?
So they kind of day-to-day impact is on things like the student and resident experience. So they do a lot of community building work within the kind of, we have four areas of the campus which are for each of the colleges. So There's that bit. There's a really fundamental contribution that they make, which is that they own the land that the university operates on still.
And they
have leased it to us in a number of, you know, different ways. So they have that really important role that each college has two members on our council. So they continue to make a contribution to our governance. And they're also, they're linked into, so three of the four colleges have different Christian foundations. So there's a C of E college, a Methodist college, and a Roman Catholic college. So, and that interacts with a really, you know, very secular university. So there's lots of interesting dynamics there that, makes quite interesting to work.
Oh, well, I'll bet it does. I'll bet it does. So, I mean, I'm really interested in this because unlike in other parts of the world, you know, there aren't many religious religious based universities in the UK, but the they've got members on council. So does any of that play out at council, or is council just genuinely acting in the best interests of the university all the time?
You
can't say that it isn't, I know, but yeah. Do issues arising from that, you know, distinctive collegiate structure come up in council dialogue?
Yes, I think so. Yes, so it's a really good board, and they do understand that their role is to act in the best interests of the university. But you know, if we're thinking about the estate and, you know, our overall financial position, questions around, you know, the college. College campuses and the relationship between the university and the colleges inevitably sort of emerge from time to time as part of council discussion, and in a really positive way. In different ways, different members bring, you know, something really important to our board, and we have you know, for within the sector, we have probably more council members who have kind of backgrounds as you know, ministers and, you know, people working within that space, and they bring a particular kind of perspective and a skill set which is quite interesting, and certainly when we're thinking about values and culture and, you know, stuff like that, they bring something that, you know, some of our council members who have spent their lives working in commercial organisations haven't really thought about before. So right. It's quite a good mix, really.
Excellent. Okay, a related question then for you, George, which is, I mean, so you've got that kind of additional layer of mild complexity on your governance, right, within the university. How does the, you know, without inviting you to get stroppy about things, but how does the external interventions, particularly the Office for Students, but there are other external agencies as well, bear down on the council? Because we're in a position now where there are more and more expectations on the governing body to certify, to assure, to do things. So in your experience, how does that play out?
They take it really seriously. So if we're thinking about the OFS, they take their responsibilities in relation to the OFS very, very seriously. There's a general understanding that it is reasonable and appropriate that in a world where students are making a significant personal contribution financially to their education, that someone should be looking out for their interests. So I think they get all of that, and broadly I don't have any problems getting them to do stuff that involves OFS compliance, right? I think, you know, there's a frustration about the way that is enacted, about probably, I think a key frustration is the level of detail that I think the OFS expects the board to be getting into around compliance. And, you know, you sort of suggested it in your question, Paul, but, you know, that so much we get from the OFS is like the board must do this and the council must have sight of this. And I feel it doesn't really recognise the wide range of responsibilities a board has, and actually the level of detail that they're able to work at as a result. And, you know, we get 10 minutes to talk about strategy. We don't have 45 minutes to go through, you know, 15 different pieces of kind of compliance work. And so there's a real question about how do we manage the board's time so that they're focusing on the things that can really make a difference. And, you know, I've heard you talk before about the kind of the burden of compliance and the burden of regulation, but, you know, that plays out in a really practical way with our council, which is, you know, if we spend too much time focusing on compliance, we haven't got time to do the things that will make us better, and will ultimately, that's what the OFS is looking for us to do. So it's a tricky one. I think practically we manage it by, you know, delegating things to our subcommittees and trying to keep as much off their plates as we can, and keeping that space for them to look at, you know, questions of strategy and broader governance. But it is a challenge. It's a real challenge.
I think you're absolutely right. And the approach you describe is the only rational one that you can do. But I think the additional layers of expectation on governing bodies continue to grow. But there was already an issue, I think, about the amount of time they were able to spend on those, you know, big strategic issues, which is where their focus should be. It's about looking to the long term, not dealing all the time with this kind of short term stuff. But that's a challenge with, you know, whether you've got an OFS or not. So I'll cut them some slack on this occasion. George, we're running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you one final question, if I may, which is, in your, you know, varied experience in different parts of higher education, you must have come across a few things, right? So I'm interested in whether there's something particularly unusual or distinctive or even amusing that you might have uncovered during your time in the sector.
The one that pops into my head is, and I know that you know this because I've seen some of the stuff that you write, is security incident reports. Which occasionally, unfortunately, a source of horror and despair and real sadness, but quite often, absolutely hilarious. I think my favourite is when I was at Brunel, there was a really very long report where a student had called security to advise them that there was another couple in the accommodation block opposite who were, you know, getting it on in a big way with their window open and their curtains open, and they weren't very happy about it. And so security said, okay. So they went up and they said, look, guys, you know your curtains are open, don't they? And they said, oh my God, are they? And they said, yeah, I think maybe you better close them next time.
You are absolutely, they are such a rich source of, you know, descriptions of the realities of university life in all its colour and diversity. Representations of higher education rarely capture, but I couldn't agree more. They do more for explaining what's really going on in university than anything else. So I'm absolutely with you there, George. Listen, we need to stop because we've run out of time. But thank you so much for the discussion and for talking about Roehampton and also your career journey. It's been terrific.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's been really nice to talk.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.